Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to a belated issue 133 of The Bugle. That's capital T-H-E space capital B-U-G-L-E, if you're transcribing this for your records. This is for the week beginning Monday the 8th of November. Sorry, I wrote that bit last week. Monday the 15th of November, 2010. I'm Andy Zaltzman in... Hang on, I'll just check outside. Looks like London. Yep, it's London. And in New York City, it's the Mahatma Gandhi of making gags, the Jesus Christ of joke cracking, the Ludwig van Beethoven of lampooning those buffoons, the Barbara Streisand of biting satire. Have I talked you up enough? It's John, the pitchfork of accountability, Oliver.
Hello, Andy. Hello, Buglers. We're back. Set your watches to bugle o'clock, because you're about to get your ears blown off. Or if not blown off, filled with so much bullshit, one of them falls off. I'm tired, Andy. I'm tired to my butt. I can't even continue that bravado.
Tied to your what?
Bones, Andy.
Oh, I thought you said butt. I thought you'd butt. Really embraced American life.
I'm tired to my butt. That's the phrase going. It's been quite a 2 weeks that we've missed. I was in DC for the run-up to the midterm elections, and I've got to say, you could feel the excitement in the air down there, Andy. If by excitement, you mean palpable discontent. And hello to any of the buglers who managed to make the trip to the rally to restore sanity. It was, without question, one of the single weirdest experiences of my life. I found myself at one point, Andy, dressed in green tights in front of 250,000 people on the National Mall, the same National Mall that saw Martin Luther King deliver his I Have a Dream speech. And let me tell you, dressed like that, with the wind whipping off the Washington Monument, my balls found out what true freedom really feels like. Real freedom, Andy. Let the eagle soar. You know that you're having a strange day if you find yourself dressed as Peter Pan, dragging Stephen Colbert off stage, turning around, nearly tripping over R2-D2 and falling into Tony Bennett. That is usually the point where you wake up in a sweat, promising not to eat pizza before going to sleep again.
Well, I guess I must make a change from you wearing green tights in front of just yourself in your own bedroom mirror.
That makes a huge difference, Andy.
That's nice.
You just get that complete sense of freedom. It's not furtive anymore.
Well, we are back after a slightly unscheduled extra week off last week. John had to do a gig in Florida, and I got a bit tied up when... it's a funny story, actually, but I was taking my kids to the playground last Thursday when two Bulgarian men approached me and said that they had some information I thought they thought I'd be interested in. And, well, you know me, John, I love info.
I
popped the kids back home, set them down by the snooker table, told them to play a best-of-35-frame match whilst I sorted out the business with the Bulgars. Anyway, half an hour later, I'm sitting in the jacuzzi at the Bulgarian embassy in Kensington with the foreign ministers of five former Soviet bloc countries and former Bulgarian football star Hristo Stoichkov. When in walks, you'll never guess, it's only bloody Leon Panetta, the head of the CIA. So anyway, he pops his togs off. Man, were those the most ripped 72-year-old pecs and abs I've ever seen, at least since I saw Judy Dench win the over-65s pole dancing world championship back in 07. So anyway, Panetta's there, cigar in one hand, two former Miss Bulgarias in the other, and he says to me, Zaltzman, if you don't have the Bashalnikov file on my desk by Monday, your arse is grass. Or more specifically, your arse is going to be underneath some grass in a woodland clearing in Wyoming. Comprende? Pass the nachos. How's the wife? So anyway, to cut a long story short, Friday afternoon, there I am, skulking around the back of the bins at the Kremlin trying to keep dark, when old Dmitry Medvedev catches me whilst he's putting his recycling out. Was that a man's body I saw tucked in amongst his copies of Russian Golf Monthly magazine? I guess we'll never know. So anyway, I panic, I ask for an autograph. He gets cranky when I tell him he's misspelt Vladimir and Putin doesn't begin with an M. I try to convince him that I'm a pro ice hockey player trying to defect. He doesn't buy it. Next thing I know, I wake up in the back of a combine harvester on a farm outside Beijing, wearing a wetsuit flippers, a Santa hat and an Elvis wig, with Chinese Army General Liang Guangli holding me in a headlock, asking me where his aircraft carrier, $10 million cash and Wi-Fi.
Wow.
And why all the fighter jets they bought off of British Aerospace were made of terracotta. I said, I thought that's how you guys like your military kit. He pins me up against a grain silo and asks me how good I am at breathing when I'm covered in corn. I say, don't know, I've been out of the game a while. He's just about to dump me in it with his trademark Cobra Clutch leg sweep, and I'm thinking, holy nutcrackers, this is going to be a strong anecdote. When his phone goes off, yeah, it's David bloody Cameron, isn't it? Offering me to swap me for the Duke of Edinburgh, who it turns out is in fact Mao Dong Wang, the chairman's son, who went undercover as a Greek prince in the war and kept his cover intact for years with offhand racist comments, but is now considered a rogue agent. So Sunday morning, I'm climbing out the Queen's bedroom window at Buckingham Palace before she wakes up and starts asking awkward questions. Catch the bus home, feed the wife some bullshit cover story about having to do a gig I'd forgotten about. She seemed happy with a special tiara and free corgi dog I'd bought her as a present, at which point my daughter Matilda charges in her waistcoat and bow tie and says, "Daddy, what comes after 15? Is it 17? And I said, "No, darling, it's 16. And she said, "Okay, Daddy, I'm two frames away from victory." So, sorry about that, but
wow,
back this week, which is nice.
Wow, and that's quite a...
Yeah, well, that's why we were away last week.
So, yeah. God, I thought my date at Florida State University with Fred Armisen was a good story.
With who?
He's on SNL, Andy. You don't know him.
All right.
He's very funny.
How was the gig?
It's fine. It's fine, Andy, but, you know, it didn't involve being pushed into a grain silo, so it just feels so mundane.
Yeah. Anyway, it's quite rare I can trump one of your stories.
Yeah, it's very impressive.
So this is Bugle 133. 133, of course, the response from the Apollo 11 crew after ground control asked them to do a final number of testicles check before blast-off on the moon expedition. "Hang on, guys," said Mission Control. "It was 222 in the run-through yesterday." "Yep, just kidding, Houston," said Buzz Aldrin. "It is 222. "But why do you always ask us that anyway?" It's protocol, Buzz. Anyway, actually, it's best you don't know. Just make sure you never shower with the guys from Apollo 10. Now put them back, zip them up, and 10, 9, 8.
Top story this week, White House Tour 2010, Asia dates. Andy, after having his arse handed to him in the midterm elections, President Obama was faced with a choice. Did he stand and fight like a man? Or did he run off on a long-scheduled, very important tour of India, Indonesia, South Korea and Japan like a president? Well, obviously it was option number two, the coward. The results of the midterm elections have made it very clear that the American people wanted Obama to focus on American jobs. And so that is what he was going to do, Andy. Even if he was 8,000 miles away, he was going to focus on some 8,000-mile-away American jobs. Even before he left, he wanted to make it painfully clear what the purpose of this trip was going to be. He held a press conference and said, "I want to be able to say to the American people when they ask me, 'Why are you spending time in India? Aren't they taking our jobs?' I want to be able to say, actually, you know what?" And then there was what felt like a long pause. And it was as if the president was considering saying, "You know what? F*** you. This job is actually really f***ing difficult. This trip is extremely important in ways that I'm not even going to bother you with now, which will probably have a very direct impact on your everyday lives. It's going to be extremely hard work, but I don't mind that, because I'm the f***ing president. What I'm not going to be doing is taking souvenir photos where I'm acting like I'm holding up or I'm about to eat the Taj Mahal, like you would if you were here, you f***ing morons." But instead, Andy, he took that pause and he said, "Actually, you know what? They just created 50,000 jobs." Now, did he do the right thing not listening to his instincts? Only history can say. All I can say is that the second version was a lot less memorable and it seemed to be a lot less fun for him to say.
His face does have that slight look about it at the moment, particularly in that press conference he did after the election results. Very much his face says, "I can't believe I've got two more years of this bullshit."
Yes.
There's sort of that face that says, "I already didn't like Republicans and now I've got even more of the obstructive little dickbags clogging up the place." He sort of looked like a Michelin-starred chef told that all he can use is a Breville machine.
Now, as international relations dictates, the president was not going to get India to insource thousands of jobs without giving them a little geopolitical sugar. And so he made what was a fairly major, albeit eventually inevitable, policy shift by calling for India to be made a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council, something which Jake Tapper here on ABC News referred to as a huge development in the world of international politics and one virulently opposed by India's nemesis, Pakistan. Nemesis? Is Pakistan permanently wearing a cape now, Andy? Is there a massive mask covering most of Waziristan? These are nation states, not Batman and the Penguin.
And by the way, much easier to think of them as that, though.
Yeah, by the the way, America is sending that nemesis billions of dollars a year in no-strings-attached aid to supposedly fight terrorism on their western border. So they had better not be spending all of that on hairless cats, swivel chairs and gigantic piranha tanks.
But it's, of course, as you say, a very important trip for Obama, John. Asia really is where it's all happening. We've all heard of it. We've all dreamt of being it. We've all wondered what it would be like if it was in the southern hemisphere instead of the north. And we've all tried to sell it on eBay.
Right.
But what do we actually know about Asia, about this big old continent that looks all set to land the Continent of the Millennium Award this millennium for the first time in five attempts? What is there to say about Asia? I know what you're thinking. Do you praise it? Japan it?
Oh, no.
Oh, it's all a bit in the air. We've all got a view on it, even animals. Even my dog has an opinion on it, and my cow.
Stop talking.
We'd be loused without it. My friend went on a backpacking holiday around Siberia last winter, actually, and when he arrived at his camp, he didn't pack his tanning lotion. So it's not looking good for his who's obviously been in the sun more competition with his mate Zachariah. Kazakhstan is better. Kazakhstan is better. Sorry, I'm not feeling too good today, John. I'm suffering from some kind of malaise, funny feeling in my limbs, in my hand, my wrist, half way down my legs, Indonesia. Even sometimes, right down to my feet. Right down to my feet. Nah, I'm okay. Feet.
That is unforgivable. Last one was absolutely unforgivable.
That was a real bummer. Well, hey, John, you'll never guess who's back. It's Dan. Yep. Our old buddy Dan, but back down in London for a couple of days. I saw him in the pub last night. He spent some time in Texas and started drinking a bit. So he comes up to me, and he says, "Howdy, a beer? Howdy, a..." Anyway, he drank a bit too much, started getting a bit aggressive, and he insulted me. So I left, and I said, "I've gone." And he said, "I've gone. It's time. It ain't big enough for the two of us."
No more.
You didn't get that one. Sorry. I can wait. Hey, John, have you been watching the Paris Masters tennis?
No. I don't think
Nadal played in the first round.
Really?
I'll just check that. No, that's right. He's not playing until the second round, is he? Yep. He Azerbaijan. Hang on, actually. Azerbaijan might be in Europe. What a mistake. That was terrible. And appalling. Bad career move. Mm-hmm. John, you're going to have to pull this round for us. So I'll tell you what always works. Why don't you sing a poor rendition of some 80s rock ballad?
Do that, yeah.
But do it quickly, I'll have to rush you. Never mind. Uh-huh. Hey, remember that hip hop show we hosted?
I do, yeah.
You and I did a rap. Am I right? Oh, hang on. I'm going to have to get this right. You and I did a rap. Am I right? United Arab Emirates. So, did that go on too long? Sorry to keep banging on.
What?
I just picked it up.
United Arab Emirates?
Yep. You and I did a rap. United Arab Emirates.
I'm going to have to throw a flag on that one,
okay.
Andy.
Fair call. I just picked it up and I ran with it. But I think I racked up quite a few puns there.
Oh, it's still happening. That's still happening.
Sorry.
I thought I was living in a world where this wasn't happening
anymore. So, no, it's done. Bhutan with the show.
F*** you!
I wrote that over lunch. Today. I don't want to put in my food. I can only apologise.
I have to say, Andy.
What, mate?
You have to credit
the
Indian government for their security operations regarding the president's
visit. Oh, back on that, are we? Right.
There is just no way to segue, Andy.
Yeah.
From what monstrosity just happened.
Yeah. Okay.
What human rights violation just occurred
over the last three minutes. About your balls, John. Your balls and a pair of green tights.
That's true.
I think I'm entitled to make a few puns.
You're just returning fire.
Yeah.
You have to credit the Indian government for their security operations. They really stopped short of absolutely nothing to keep the president safe. Their interpretation of maximum security included removing coconuts in Mumbai that may have fallen on the president's head from trees. That was very wise, Andy. There is a history of assassination attempts from international falling fruit. Who could forget when a pineapple tried to kill Lyndon Johnson? Luckily, a Secret Serviceman dived in front of the pineapple and just headed it away. Also, I believe that Reagan was actually hit by a kiwi fruit, but luckily got him in the thigh and was not fatal. So thank you very much, India, for keeping 44 safe.
That's right. And John Wilkes Booth actually hurled a kumquat at Abraham Lincoln, but he had coated it in lead and put it in a gun.
That's right. From India, it was on to Indonesia, Obama's childhood home, or to put it another way, somewhere he could go back to his roots. Now, he took the time while there to visit the world's biggest mosque, presumably because he's just not sure he wants a second term in office. Such a trip undoubtedly has a tangibly positive effect in improving relations with the Muslim world, but it's also giving more credit to aspects of the American media than they deserve or indeed can be trusted with. He even opened his speech over there with Assalamu Alaikum and continued, "Let me begin with a simple statement. Indonesia is part of me." And there were clearly radio hosts back in America screaming into their microphones, "I knew it! I knew! They called me a racist!" And while, yes, as it happens, I am a racist, I have at least in this instance been proved right. Now, clearly, this trip to the Muslim world is a vital bridge-building exercise, especially at the moment. Bear in mind that there are some Americans that are having trouble differentiating between Muslims, of which there are hundreds of millions, and terrorists, of which there are hundreds. It's like, and you know, I think these numbers are roughly to scale, it's like if people in the Muslim world were unable to distinguish between Americans and professional baseball players. That would be ridiculous and offensive. Very, very few Americans are professional baseball players. And furthermore, it's worth noting that not all professional baseball players are actually American.
But they do tend to have American sympathies.
Yes, that is true.
David Cameron, he's been jetting around Asia as well. He's been to China and told them quite quietly to smarten up their human rights shtick. And he did this in a speech in a school, which apparently wasn't broadcast on Chinese television, strangely enough. And he had to be seen to do it, John. And I guess the Chinese knew that he had to be seen to do it. And you know, I guess he was quite safe from their point of view. He's not the kind of guy, David Cameron, to chain himself to some railings, start shouting "Free Tibet," and then rip open his jacket to reveal a T-shirt with the slogan "Chairman Mao is a tool" on it. So I guess they could trust him. And we've had a student riots here, and I can only imagine that President Hu Jintao just tapped him on the shoulder as they lined up for the G20 meeting and said, "Call that a student protest. You want to try one of ours?"
It's actually not all been smooth sailing for the First Lady on this tour either. She caused a major controversy by shaking hands with a conservative Muslim information minister in Indonesia. Now, that might not sound earth-shatteringly scandalous at first, but the problem was that this violated the minister's pious claim that he avoids contact with women that are not related to him. And he actually blamed Michelle Obama, claiming that the touching was not his fault, saying, "I tried to prevent from being touched my hands, but Mrs. Michelle held her hands too far toward me, so we touched." That's a very interesting interpretation of the greeting, as the video of their meeting seems to fairly clearly show him smiling, eager to meet the First Lady, and clasping her hands with absolutely no hesitation at all. And it turns out he's a very polarising figure in Indonesia, and people there seem to be enjoying this chance to call him down from his hypocritical moral high horse. This is a man who just last year said that Indonesian sins were responsible for the earthquakes, tsunamis and other natural disasters that have recently struck them, and then linked the destruction of those events to the country's involvement in the production of pornographic videos. He's also used his Twitter account to post jokes about AIDS patients. So it's somehow comforting to know that there are not only arsehole politicians everywhere, but also people waiting to laugh at them when they eventually, as I believe the saying goes, f*** themselves in the foot.
It's an old ancient Greek expression, that, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
I think Homer first wrote that, didn't he? It was Achilles' first major injury, certainly.
Midterm election update now. And, well, it's pure political nature, Andy, in a dance as old as time. The party in power in the US will have the electorate kick it in the balls during the midterms. And sure enough, Obama and the Democrats received that electoral nutshot on November the 2nd. And it was a nutshot strong enough to lose them control of Congress, but not quite strong enough that they would crumple to the floor and lose the Senate too. The results may force the White House to now refocus their agenda, and it will certainly mean they have to work with the Republicans on budgeting, which is like saying that you have to work with a fat crocodile on budgeting. The crocodile is going to obstinately refuse to help at all in those negotiations, and if you try to show it a potential compromise bill, it'll either take a dump on it or try to eat it. That's what he's dealing with here.
And it just would have spent all his money on sunglasses as well.
One of the key questions for this administration is what to do about US debt. Now, in response, Obama has appointed a bipartisan commission on reducing national debt, charged with coming up with a way to reduce the debt in a way that will piss off as many people, fewer than absolutely everyone, as possible. And it is, of course, not going to be easy. Europe has been sporadically in flames over this very issue for much of the last 6 months. The commission outlined on Wednesday a provocative and economically ambitious package of spending cuts and tax increases, and probably should have done so wearing crash helmets to protect themselves when chairs started inevitably flying across the room towards them. Alan K. Simpson, the Republican co-chairman, is under absolutely no illusion of just how shit his job is. He had a very nice turn of phrase regarding the situation America finds itself in. He said, "It's time to lay it out on the table and let the American people start to chew on it." Isn't that fantastic?
Crumbs, I believe Bill Clinton was the first politician to say that.
You're right, I think it was a direct quote. That's why it had so much resonance. Clinton was way ahead of his time.
Kind of, I do feel sorry for poor little Barack Obama. And, yeah. Those halcyon days when he was shouting "Yes, we can" for every possible camera do seem a long time away. And now you feel worried. He doesn't really say it anymore, does he?
No.
"Yes, we can." I mean, I guess he would have to add brackets, provided that the innately obstructive nature of democratic politics does not prevent us from doing so. And more likely, no, we f***ing can't. And it's interesting, actually, looking at this from a British perspective, because over here we have David Cameron as Prime Minister. And you know, he's doing adequately, I think, in the polls. Not great, not terribly. But the great problem for Barack Obama was the expectations, which he made the crucial and schoolboy error of raising them.
Yes.
Whereas David Cameron became Prime Minister with everyone in this country, A, not really wanting him, and B, expecting him to be shit.
Right.
So he is in a absolute pole position politically, Cameron. And Obama must be rather jealous, I think.
It's so polarised, America now. And that makes what this bipartisan debt commission has achieved even more remarkable, especially after the midterm elections. It seemed as though there was literally nothing the two parties could agree on. But this commission has now somehow managed to unite the Republicans and the Democrats in that they both absolutely hate these proposals. Deep spending cuts are in there to piss off the Democrats, substantial tax increases to piss off the Republicans, to ensure that chairs are being thrown at them from both sides of the aisle in an inspiring demonstration of bipartisan fury.
It's amazing. The level of froth can be seen from space with a naked eye, apparently. And it does appear that America has gone fully caked-in crazy. And it does seem there's quite a strong just anti-politics vote, as we had over here in the general election as well. And there just seems to be a general view amongst the public that the lunatics are running the asylum, which may be true, but it does not take away from the fact that the asylum is still full of other lunatics.
Yes.
British Revolution now, and, well, it looks like the government and the monarchy are going to be overthrown within days, John, by British students. They've been protesting, about 50,000 students protesting, generally in a quite a good-natured way. And no one was taking much notice of it. And then a small group of them started smashing Conservative Party headquarters to pieces. And all of a sudden, the entire British media was all over it. And there was this one amazing photo in the paper of a student throwing something through the front window of the Conservative office on Millbank. And the front two rows of the people surrounding him were all press photographers or TV cameramen. And this just goes to prove the first rule of protesting: behave yourself and you get page 23 of The Guardian. Chuck a brick at a window and it is front page news.
That is the thing. That's this supposed breakaway faction had clearly learned the key lesson of modern news media. Namely, if you, as a protester, want to be on it, you're going to need to break something. Does that help your cause? No. Does it illuminate the discussion? No. Does it guarantee national and international news coverage? Absolutely it does. I was seeing live shots from Milbank on CNN and Fox News here, and they were covering it like it was an emerging civil war. And yet, it really did look like some of the protesters were just going through the motions of petty vandalism. Like you say, I saw that clip on the news, about 30 photographers, one guy standing in front of a window, and you can see him thinking, okay, you win, I'll kick it in. But you better spell my name right in the story. The giveaway that this was not a revolution happening on the streets was there was a Pizza Express in the background of one of the shots, and people seemed to be happily eating in there. And let it be said that there are very few revolutions throughout history that have involved people watching eating pizza. Waiter, can we have an extra serving of garlic knots, please? It looks like we could be here for a while.
You clearly weren't in Italy in 1848. But I think the problem is the government set a very bad example, John, with its violent protests, in particular against Saddam Hussein. I mean, would that have got so much media traction if there hadn't been a small minority causing damage at the front of it? I don't know. But I think the media need to grow up about this, and maybe they should adopt the same policy that sports broadcasters generally do now with streakers, in which they don't show them, then they make some cryptic comment about an intruder interrupting play whilst the camera pans to a shot of a burger van, and then you have to guess the gender and full extent of clothlessness of the offender by the tremor in the commentator's voice. So maybe they should do that. Just don't broadcast the naughty bits of the protest, and they'll soon stop doing it. But as a problem, if they hadn't smashed anything up, it would have been, oh, look at the little students.
Yes.
Well done, them.
Yeah.
Now, as it is, it has been the main news story for the last 3 days.
It's a lose-lose situation.
It certainly is. And Ed Balls, the Shadow Home Secretary, he said the violence was completely unacceptable and perpetrated by a small minority of thugs who hijacked what was planned to be a legitimate and peaceful demonstration, and in so doing, denied tens of thousands of students and lecturers the right to have their voices properly heard. And when he said properly heard, what he means is largely ignored. there was one rather priceless comment on a message board underneath a newspaper article about this. Someone had written, "I might be mistaken, but the measures announced won't affect current students. So what are they protesting about?"
That's the spirit.
Remarkable level of cynicism.
Help me understand. You're not personally losing anything. Why do you give a shit?
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, there's a history, certainly, of that great anti-war march back in February 2003, 1.5 million people on the streets of London. And every single one of them was an Iraqi living in downtown Baghdad.
That's right. Feature section now, Australia! Andy, you know that a country has done something pretty special when it merits a feature section all to itself. You know, you look at Dubai and its stupid buildings. And Australia this week has more than deserved such an honour with the stories you're about to hear. A 25-year-old man went into a tattoo parlour in Queensland and asked for a yin and yang symbol and some dragons on his back. And in return, the tattoo artist inked a 16-inch penis onto his back instead. Now, apparently, there was someone else in there who, during the tattoo procedure, said, "Mate, it's looking really good." And I just love the idea that he just assumed that this guy wanted a 16-inch penis on his back, in which case he was getting a really good one. This looks fantastic. I think you're going to be really pleased with this. It's so unique. Better than the dolphin just above your hip. When he got home, apparently he showed it to the person he lives with, and she said, "I don't think it's the tattoo you were after." And again, it would be great if you said, "Why? Oh, God, is it not a huge 16-inch penis?" "Oh, yes, it is. It is that. Oh, phew." For a second, I thought there'd been a mistake and that there was some stupid yin and yang symbol or something. Or... I'd like it to be an honest mistake and that the tattoo artist honestly thought that the symbol for yin and yang was a massive 16-inch penis.
Well, it's easily mistaken, isn't it?
Yes, of course it is.
Yeah. I know. I certainly call my little gentleman Mr. Ying and Mr. Yang. But it's pretty hard to pass that off, isn't it, that kind of tattoo, even if you are deeply religious.
Yeah.
And you think, you know, well, you know, God obviously likes penises,
yeah,
since he made them. So yeah, why not have a 16-inch penis on your back? I mean, yeah, you'd expect that from a, you know, only a very senior archbishop.
I think that's
why they wear such long cloaks to cover up all the woolly tattoos.
I think that's what you do. You put it onto other people and say, give me 5 good reasons why I should not have a 16-inch pizza nose on my back. Well, that's 4. That's, you give me 4. I need a 5th, or I'm not sorry.
Does teach a very valuable lesson. I think a lesson that everyone could do well to learn, and that is, do not let people give you tattoos on parts of your body that you cannot see.
Yes, yes.
That is basic stuff, John. Basic. And also, another spectacular bit of national stereotype confirming that Australia seems particularly good at the moment.
Yes.
But I think, actually, since Tom moved to Australia, Australian national behaviour seems to have plummeted even further. But a top rugby league player, Joel Monaghan of the Canberra Raiders, has resigned from his club after a photograph came to light of him, well, putting his chaplain into the mouth of a dog. And I mean, there's no real way to talk around that, John. He put his wang in a dog's mouth and took a photo of it. And you know, this in no way detracts from his qualities as a rugby league player.
Right.
You know,
I think
it's not.
Right.
If he did it in a game, that is a different matter.
Yeah, when that's a penalty, I think.
I think it is a penalty.
Yeah.
Well, it depends whether the dog was offside. But I mean, he's been properly contrite about it. But it is certainly a career blooper. And it is hard to imagine the thought processes, even for a pro rugby league player. And, you know, I think Australian rugby league players are not generally viewed to be contenders for Nobel Prizes. But mm-hmm. I think even then, there's just a few steps in the logical process between I'm a professional rugby league player and I'm putting my penis in a dog's mouth. I just can't quite make those steps. All of which, of course, is good news for the England cricket team as Australian national morale plummets ahead of the Ashes, which begins in a couple of weeks. So this is it's all very good. But the bad news is that the as part of the international currency wars, the Australian government have been artificially manipulating the Aussie dollar. So it's very strong at the moment. This has priced out English fans from going over to Australia. And this is all they've got now. They used to have great cricketers, and now they have to manipulate the international currency markets to stop our crucial supporters getting over there. That's sad to see. Sad to see the levels Australia have sunk to. Your emails now, and this one comes in from Anne Anderson, who writes on the subject, "The reviews are in. The Bugle, No Bugle, is a Zen masterpiece. Congratulations, gentlemen," writes Anne. "Your most recent podcast, The Bugle, episode 132 and an old bit, No Bugle, is a triumph of artistic integrity. Your intentional mislead of your audience with 8.5 minutes of half-remembered Edinburgh show had me fooled completely. I was completely unprepared for the half-hour Zen Buddhist journey of self-discovery you inspired. Your long-form comedy cavalcade of 29 minutes and 11 seconds of complete silence has taken stand-up comedy to a new level of artistic achievement." So I'm sorry. I'm sorry for those of you who tried to download last week's podcast and it didn't work. We've had a few technical problems. Who's to blame for those, Ped?
Fuck slice.
Bloody hell, left field. Ped standing in for Chris this week.
And that is a lead-off hit.
He is putting in a strong bid to be retained on a weekly basis.
Wow. That is outstanding. Not even a moment's hesitation.
Yeah.
Also, you ask a question, you want an answer, I'll give you the answer. It's Fox Slice's fault.
Yeah. Could refer to Chris, could refer to iTunes, could be anyone.
It's a very political response.
Hitler, and that's what Winston Churchill used to call Hitler, apparently.
Yes.
That was his code name, Fox Slice. We want Fox Slice, dead or alive. Preferably alive. So sorry. Anyway, Anne continues. "In the first moments of blank silence, my mind still focused on the physical world around me. And my first thoughts were along the lines of, oh, for f*** sake, again, really, and God damn it, Chris, now what the f*** gone wrong? Then it occurred to me how the podcast reminded me of the John Cage magnum opus 4 minutes 33 seconds and the white canvas paintings of Robert Rauschenberg. Their audiences were invited to experience the ambient noises in the silent concert hall and the delicate interplay of light and colour and shadow on the white paintings as an integral part of each piece, and I settled in and allowed the experience to take over as you pushed the frontiers of comedy. I have to say, I have done gigs where there's been 29 minutes and 11 seconds of complete silence, albeit not on my side of the microphone, but on the other side of the microphone. Several minutes along, I wonder what John, Andy and Chris were doing during the silent podcast. I imagined a series of deliberate yet satirical comedy movements from the three of you. So anyway, she goes on. And I think you've made your point, Anne. You've made your point that you were annoyed that you didn't get the full podcast. I hope it is now fully available. The extra half hour of the absolute gold from 2005. Did you have you listened to it yet, John?
No. Yeah. No. Do you remember the gig?
It was the Frontline Club. I think it was in June 2005.
Ooh, that's some half-baked material, Andy.
Well, it was actually fully baked from previous year's Edinburgh, but largely forgotten.
Right.
So it's a bit choppy in places. Yeah. So, yeah, it's not bad.
Okay.
Certainly worth giving away free. So
certainly worth nothing, is that what you're saying?
So do keep your emails coming into thebugle@timesonline.co.uk, and thanks to those of you who alerted us to those two Australian stories.
Yeah, good
instinct.
A lot
of you emailed or tweeted them to us.
Good instinct. Such a nice thing that people would see a story like that and think of us, Andy.
And don't forget, you can follow the Bugle Twitter feed @HelloBuglers. Creeping up towards 10,000 followers now, John. That's more than Jesus ever managed when he was alive, wasn't it?
True. Pitiful 12.
Yeah. So
hardly what you'd call a success.
So that's about it for this week.
That's it.
Well, John and I need to go and get some sleep. By the sounds of it,
I got nothing left.
I don't think this has been the perkiest bugle of all time.
I got
John.
Nothing, Andy. Yeah. I am burnt out.
Yeah. I'm afraid I blew what little creative energy I had left this week on my bullshit story about being kidnapped, and then my 25 puns. Around Asian countries, and
that was running a marathon and deciding to sprint the first 300 metres, Andy.
Oh, there have been some pretty big issues in the last 3 weeks that we've not been on, and this could have been an ideal time to satirise the world, John. But
I'm so tired.
I am so tired
and actually tired. I got nothing.
Still puns.
I got nothing.
Yep, that's the way forward.
Yeah. Anyway.
So, Buglers, do keep your emails and caffeine tablets coming in to thebugle@timesonline.co.uk. And we'll be back, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, next week with Bugle 134.
I can't promise that, Andy. I do not have next week off. If anything, I'm likely to be even worse next week.
All right.
Still, let's look on the bright side. Yep. Just explain to me where that bright side is. And I'll look on it. God. Have a good week, Buglers.
Yep.
Hopefully we'll speak to you next week. No promises.
It might just be snoring. Just 30 minutes of snoring.
Yeah. It could be.
That was a review you had once, wasn't it?
Yeah. Until they realise they've been sitting there for an hour. Bye, Buglers.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Wait till you have kids, John. That's going to really crank it up. Are you going to adopt an African kid or something, since you've been in a film? Is that,
Well, I think that's what I'm supposed to do now, Andy. Yeah. Certainly once the Smurfs comes out.
They'll be queuing up.
I'm not going to be able to move.